Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Hi there! This is Get Off My World. We're a bunch of middle-aged guys who've grown up watching the old Doctor Who series. And yes, we're still watching it after all these years. I'm Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
And I'm Joshua.
And this week, we're joined by our sound engineer and longtime companion, Tony Carno.
Oh, that just sounds uncool.
We're finally acknowledging the existence of the guy who twiddles the knobs.
Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Myselves?
Would you like to introduce yourselves?
I'll start with one and we'll see how it goes.
You're on your like third regeneration arc.
Seems that way.
Tony, would you like to introduce yourself to
sure.
our listeners?
I first met Josh after a show where he stabbed himself in the hand.
Yes, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Was there blood, Tony?
There was a lot of blood. Do you remember which show that was, or is that not
could have been
down
any
enough?
Time.
Yeah, no.
Really, it blurs together.
It was a fringe show, God, like 12 years ago now, and it was at a tiny little stage that was about 900 degrees, and you were doing an office sketch, and you stabbed yourself in the hand with a pair of scissors accidentally, but comedically. And you were sweating so much that the blood just rolled down your hand and got on your shirt. I think at one point you tried to glue it shut with some Elmer's glue and put some tape over it. And it was pretty epic. And so I figured, I want to work with these guys.
Tony, like a shark, is attracted to blood.
Yeah.
But Tony, you've also been hanging out with us for over a year now, recording these podcasts.
Yep.
There was one appearance in our season 8 special where you, as the voice of God, came in to opine on the Peter Capaldi season.
Oh, yeah. My headcanon.
Your headcanon.
Yeah. Which I still think is better than the whole series, but anyway.
We'll put a pin in that.
Yes!
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Yay!
You've been a great sound engineer this entire time, and we're happy to have you as a guest.
It's fun to be here.
So, as always, we're going to take you through 5 rounds rapid, listeners. And we're going to start out with the round we call Temporal Grace, in which we say something that we love about the world of Doctor Who. Josh, do you want to start this week?
Well, we're recording this in October, but this will probably go out in December, so I'm already anticipating what Doctor Who-related items I want for the holidays. And number one on my list, family, if you're listening.
If you're listening to your father's podcast.
As you should be, is the War Doctor audios from Big Finish.
Yeah.
Which may already be out when you're listening to my voice, so run to the computer. Stop playing this podcast right now. Go to bigfinish.com and order your dad the War Doctor audios. John Hurt is coming back. He's how much of a War Doctor? He's fighting cancer and recording Doctor Who audios. He is my new hero. And then you could also throw in the 5-inch War Doctor action figure, which I don't have. That would make a great 1-2 Christmas punch. All right, kids? Seriously, they're not listening. They don't listen to me in person. Why would they be listening to me now? But it's been firmly documented.
Here's your variable speed drill, Dad.
Damn it!
Isn't it true that this is the only way you communicate with your children?
It's the only way. So, hold on a second. Do your homework. Okay, we're good.
Well, Kelvin, what about you? Temporal Grace, what do you love?
I was unaware this was a thing, but apparently at some point there were plans to do a Doctor Who radio show involving the Peter Cushing Doctor.
Where did you hear this?
You're full of lies.
I saw it mentioned on some online article, and it was like footnoted and stuff. So
it must be true.
But apparently, yeah, it was gonna be the Peter Cushing Doctor and whoever played Susan in the movies. They apparently got so far as to commissioning a script which had them visiting, of all things, the American Revolution. And I don't know if, like, anything was committed to tape or not, like some kind of test recording or something, but they put the kibosh on it and never happened. But apparently that was going to maybe be a thing.
Oh, well, that's a shame that didn't happen.
Yeah, I was just really kind of amazed.
Tony?
Well, mine is actually related to the episode we're going to talk about today. It's about the Keeper of Trocken. I found out when I was rewatching it this week, and I watched it with my wife, Emily, that she had never seen any full episodes of classic Doctor Who. And so
what?
It was.
And you married this woman?
I know! But it's a really fun episode, and it's all full of Art Nouveau and great art direction, so it was a perfect one for her to see, and Tom Baker, and everyone puts in a great performance, and it was a very lovely way to watch an episode and have that be the first thing that she got to see, a full-length old classic Who.
Oh, that's so domestic.
Yeah.
That's great.
So is she going to watch more?
She might.
She might.
Yeah. We're not going to commit, but there's plenty of stuff to work through. Don't have a lot of viewing hours available.
Well, as Josh said, this episode is probably being broadcast in the middle of December 2015, but we're recording it several months earlier. And only a few weeks ago, as regular listeners of our show will know, if there are such creatures, we did a live performance at the Bryant Lake Bowl here in Minneapolis of Get Off My World, which should have been broadcast sometime about the time we're recording this. And we had a great time, and one of the questions before the panel was, what in Doctor Who has ever made you cry? And we were all kind of dry about the whole thing.
Yeah.
We're not really emotionally moved in general by Doctor Who.
I'm usually a little too inebriated to experience genuine emotion. Yes.
We're not too moved in the verklempt direction, yeah. We'll say. But a few days later, when I was at the Bryant Lake Bowl, because I go there regularly, one of my regular servers came over and talked to me for a little while. She had not been our server that night in the theater at the BLB, yeah. But she wound up watching most of our performance, as it turned out. And turns out she's a fan of the new series, and she took us to task for not talking about Matt Smith's goodbye in Time and the Doctor, which I admit I had forgotten about when we were on stage there, but I want to give a nice little shout out there to Matt Smith's sad little goodbye. We all change when you think about it. We're all different people all through our lives, and that's okay. That's good as long as you keep moving, as long as you remember all the people that you used to be. I will not forget one line of this, not one day, I swear. I will always remember when the Doctor was me. It is kind of a tear-jerky moment, and I was happy to have her remind me of that. So here's a little shout-out for that. Also, that anyone's watching, that anyone's watching and listening to us out there, that I'm happy about.
Now it's time for round two, Special Topics Dalek. When we're recording this, it's pretty much at our one-year anniversary, and when this podcast will be going out, it's right before the new year, so we decided that we would look back at 1 year of this podcast and discuss our origins and the state of the podcast today and what we're looking forward to in the future. Pat, do you remember way back when we first started talking about this podcast?
I kinda do. In summer 2014, you and I were talking at Tim Uren's wedding. And now we've known each other a long time. We've known Calvin and Tony a long time, too. And so we've talked plenty about Doctor Who in the past. But at this point, the Peter Capaldi season had been announced but hadn't started yet. So we started chatting about what things we thought might be promising or not so promising about the new series. And it was a few weeks after that, I think, that you gave me a Facebook message and said, hey, what do you think about this idea about doing a Doctor Who podcast? My first reaction was, that's the most preposterous thing I've ever heard. Why on earth would I want to do a Doctor Who podcast? And then after a few moments, I was like, that sounds actually like a terrific idea and exactly what I want to do. You happened to hit me at a very good time, and I'm grateful for that because I've had a very good time in this last year, but we'll get to that. We had an initial meeting, and of course, the first person that we wanted to bring in was Kelvin, who we've known a long time and knows more about Doctor Who and kind of nerd stuff in general than anybody else could have thought. Well done, sir. Faked it for like the last 25 years or whatever.
We were also very afraid of our cynical natures, and we wanted someone who we thought might be more positive to balance things out.
I think that's definitely been how it's shaken out, I would say.
Well, I think you're a good influence on us. You moderate our negative tendencies, or at least mine.
Yeah, okay.
Naturally
you
optimistic.
You just make me angrier, Calvin. Just the sight of you.
And, of course, Tony, who we've known for a long time, and Josh and Kelvin, you guys have worked with on any number of theatrical things, was the ideal person to be our sound engineer, not only because of your skills, but because you like the subject matter, and we think you like us more or less. So that was kind of how it started. And we came up with the five rounds fairly rapidly, I think. We had that. I think five rounds rapid was initially our idea for what the title of the podcast would be, but somebody else had taken it. There's something else out there in Doctor Who land,
An actual British soldier shooting something.
Yes.
Well, we thought it would get buried in Google in any case, so Get Off My World seemed to be less taken.
Yes.
And so it began. And so the legend began. So what do you guys think about how we've been doing for the last year? Well, badly, what's worked, what hasn't worked, what should we do better in the years to come, the 50 years to come, do this podcast?
Yes, but we will be discussing the 37th Doctor, who is a cloud of nanoparticles.
When we started the idea of doing this podcast, I thought, oh, this is nothing. I talk about Doctor Who, you know, just get me going. Just get me going, and I'll talk about Doctor Who. It doesn't matter. I don't need to watch anything. I don't need to read anything. That rapidly turned out to not be the case. I actually do need to do homework for each of these podcasts, and I'll give our listeners a look behind the curtain. We record two of these at once. So everything you hear us talk about, we've had to do two episodes worth of prep every time you're hearing our voices. So at the beginning, when we were doing things like The Gunfighters versus A Town Called Mercy in the Death Zone, plus a randomizer, plus maybe a special topics Dalek, and we're doing two of these episodes at the time, all of a sudden we're talking about having to research like 8 or 10 hours of Doctor Who before we before we could actually record a thing. And that rapidly became unworkable. So I think that's how we've revised The Death Zone, for example. Like, we don't do a classic versus a new series anymore. We'll do a Big Finish, maybe, versus a new series, because it's easier to incorporate Big Finish audio stuff in your everyday life. I listen to it on the bus, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But to sit down and actually schedule the time to watch it becomes kind of challenging.
Well, also, you started doing guests to make them do the homework instead.
Yes. Yes, we
did. Well, I do want to do the War Games versus the Chase at some point.
Well, there we go. I think that's now. We have to do that.
You had to put.
I don't know what. They're not really related on any level except length.
You just shot yourself in the foot, Kelvin, because we're doing it.
Put that on record, Kelvin. Okay, we do the War Games versus the Daleks Master Plan.
Well, because that's mostly missing.
Well, we've never done three things. Yeah. We can do all three of them versus each other.
All three.
Well, this could be a direction that we take in the future, for example. We could break our five-round structure, or we could have episodes that have five rounds about, say, just the Dalek Master Plan. So, you know, a temporal grace of something we love about the Dalek Master Plan.
Yeah, if there's a particularly huge thing, or, you know, gosh, if we actually do a novel again or something, you know, we can just do the whole thing on that.
Well, when I first was kicking around the idea of five rounds rapid, it was sort of in response to listening to some other podcasts where they would take one episode and they would talk about it for an hour. And then there were some other magazine-style podcasts that had slicker production values, much slicker production values than we have, where they do a lot of little segments. And my original thinking was, can we marry those two that has the very informal chat style, But with the five rounds that we move through a lot of topics. So if one topic doesn't terribly interest a listener, that we are within 10 to 15 minutes going to move on to something else, sort of to keep people's interest.
Yeah, I think your initial impulse there toward the rounds is a good one. The podcasts that I like listening to, things that are more than just kind of sketches like Welcome to Night Vale or whatever. I'm thinking of podcasts like Caustic Soda or whatever, and they have individual rounds which keep some sort of structure. They have one topic that they're going to talk about for the entire time, but they have individual approaches toward it that are broken down into 5, 10, 15-minute segments. And I think that's kept us on track, and although we can certainly ramble, we're restrained from rambling for an entire freaking hour.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of the podcasts I like listening to are essentially just one-on-one conversations that are like an hour and a half in length. But they also always seem to involve people who seem to have drank like a pot of coffee just before hitting record and somehow having bladders the size of a steel drum or something. But yeah, those are the ones I always enjoy listening to.
Yes, my bladder is. You don't want to know.
It's like a pint glass.
What about you, Tony? As it's sitting away from us, judging us for the last year.
Oh, yes.
Are there constantly things that
you're like the gods of Ragnarok, the greatest show in the galaxy?
Absolutely. No, I think there's been a really good balance on the episode structures, and having the guests coming in every so often has made for some interesting variety, but it still keeps within the structure. And it's been going really well. It's certainly been fun to sit here and watch and listen the whole time. So I don't know how much people are enjoying it online, but I'm having fun. So
that's one thing that I would like to see more of is audience interaction. I think we've been a little bit lax about reaching out to the audience and trying to get more feedback. So anyone listening to this, I encourage you, please comment on our Facebook page, comment on getoffmyworldpodcast.com, email us at getoffmyworld@gmail.com. Please let us know what you're thinking, what you like, what you don't like, and we'll try to incorporate new ideas into the future.
One thing I would like to try to do is to try to turn some of these around a little faster into big Finnish audios that are coming out really recently, big box sets.
Sixth Doctor Last Adventure.
Sixth Doctor Last Adventure, which has already been out for months, which we hope to talk about sometime soon. But that kind of thing, and maybe we will experiment like a little bit more with that.
What is it called? The Doom Committee or something?
The Doom Coalition, which just came out the month we're recording this. That's the new Eighth Doctor box set.
Yeah.
I think some of this stuff is more and more arguably canonical, particularly with Paul McGann's Doctor, and something worth dipping into a little bit more and encouraging fans of the old series and new series to listen to.
I would also like to, if we can schedule it in, do more novels. Kelvin mentioned this earlier.
That does take some time.
That's the thing, you know. So much of Doctor Who exists in sometimes very good novels.
Yeah.
The Virgin and BBC books that were there during the Wilderness years. But we've only so far found the time to do one of them, Paul Cornell's Human Nature. We took two episodes to cover it. In part because it took that long to schedule in reading a 350-page novel. That's a little different than watching an hour and a half adventure when you're doing two of these, et cetera, et cetera, blah, blah.
We might have to do a thing where, like, just start reading it now and we'll get to it in the summer or something.
Well, no, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot and suggest Gary Russell, I'm blanking on the name of the novel, wrote The Sixth Doctor's Last Adventure in a...
Spiral Scratch,
that's it, in a past Doctor's adventure in the early 2000s, I believe. So that would be a fun death zone.
The novel versus the
final adventure made by Big Finish.
You heard it here first.
that dovetails about as nicely as you could hope.
That's perfect. Yeah, I totally want to do that. I'll make an early New Year's resolution to say we'll do that on the podcast in the following year.
Well, if we plan it now, that actually gives enough time by the time this podcast comes out that you could actually have it read by then.
Ooh, timey-wimey.
But I also want to do novels by Lance Parkin. by Lawrence Miles, by Steve Lyons. There's quite a number of other, David McKinty, who have written quite a few Doctor Who books that I've read in the past that I like a lot, that are as good as anything that we've seen broadcast.
And I think some fans of the new series who may not be as familiar with Doctor Who before 2005, I think would be interested in hearing some of this stuff that heavily influenced Russell T. Davies and the new series forward.
Yeah, well, and Russell T. and Mark Gatiss both wrote novels for the Virgin books. So that's an underserved part of Doctor Who canon that I think we can do more of as the podcast goes on. It's just difficult to schedule because it's hard to make sure we're all on the same page about that. I want to get more women's voices on this show. We've had Ariel, we've had Melissa Karcher, and Wendy Bowlesby. It has been challenging to find women who are fans of the old series. Frankly admit that. That's there aren't really that many that we know. So
we know they're out there.
Suggestions are welcome. And, of course, we can open this up to fans of the new series, too.
We do in our mother's basements. We don't actually know a whole lot of women.
Living as we do in Kelvin's mother's basement.
She's a very generous, kind woman.
Yeah. So tolerant.
So, final thoughts on the podcast. I want to particularly call out Josh here for being such a booster of the podcast. Oh, I know. Oh. We did the Brian Lee Bull show not terribly long ago. It was terrifically fun. It was not something that I would have ever dreamed of doing in my life, but you guys are, of course, so deeply involved in the Twin Cities actor community that Josh is like, well, let's do a show. Doesn't matter if anybody shows up. Let's do a show. 1 year anniversary. It's like, okay, let's do it. I thought it was a great success. Mm-hmm. I'd love to do it again. And I think our audience had a good time, too. So hopefully our listeners do, too, when they listen.
There was an audience. It wasn't just like...
My parents were there.
Yeah.
You're like, why are you living with Kevin's mother?
I have a basement, too, you know. Okay, next up on the podcast, instead of our usual randomizer segment, we are going to do the Tony Miser. We are doing a selection as picked by our guest, Tony Karna. I feel weird calling you a guest. I mean, you're here every bloody time.
He's more of a pest.
More of a pest than a guest. But anyway, Tony, what did you pick and why?
Well, I picked the Keeper of Trakan because I didn't know it at the time, but it was the very first bit of Doctor Who that I ever saw because... when I lived up in the North Woods of Minnesota, we had everything on antenna. We didn't have cable or anything like that. And there were two PBS stations you could get. One of them was in Duluth, and you had to turn the antenna towards Duluth to get that one. The other was in Bemidji, which was 180 degrees in the other direction. So you had to go out and turn the antenna in the other direction. And so there was one night I was checking to see what was on the Bemidji PBS station. And I caught what turned out to be the last 60 seconds of Keeper of Trakan. I just timed it out. I was watching it here at Pat's before we started. The last 60 seconds of Keeper of Trakan consists of Trimas and Nyssa in Trimas's office. Nyssa's saying something about, oh, you should come do something. And he says, oh, I have to do something in my office, and I'll be there. And she leaves. He turns towards the grandfather clock, which has mysteriously appeared in the background. It walks towards it, puts his hand up to it as if he's going to correct the time, freezes in place for some reason that you can't tell what's going on if you just happen to have turned the TV on at 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday. This creepy, disfigured form creeps out of the grandfather clock and says, a new body, a new body. Goes up behind him.
They do the
dissolved shot where he takes over Trimas's body, goes back in the grandfather clock, disappears. The girl comes back in, father, end credits theme. That's it. There's no Tom Baker. There's nothing.
It's just like, F you, Tony.
And I didn't see it again for about 3 weeks because I didn't see Legopolis. I didn't see Castrovalvis. The first full episode I saw was some random Peter Davison episode.
Next chronologically would be Four to Doomsday.
Yeah. So I don't
favorite.
I don't.
It is not my favorite. I just think it's very underrated. Okay.
You're Jeepers. Wrong, Kevin.
I don't think I even knew what Doctor Who was at that point because there was no internet or anything, so I would have never heard of it. The only thing I might have known it was in the local bookstore. I used to go through the D&D manuals and things like that, and one of the things they had was I don't know if it was Dragon Magazine or one of the gaming magazines used to do Doctor Who role-playing game character profiles. Mm-hmm. And I'd read through those every so often. I remember one in particular was the profile they had for the Colin Baker Doctor and describing his personality as theorizing that, oh, multiple regenerations causes a more and more unstable personality to come out like that. And that might have been the only way that I ever heard of Doctor Who until seeing that last 60 seconds of this episode.
Wow.
So that was why I picked that one, because I asked you guys, which one is that?
And
you guys
and said, we all and I watched it. In like about yep. 10, you know, yep. a split second later.
I think the particular image I had of the burned master from the end of that was he looked like a blackened cabbage. Because he's got the collar on the robe there, and his face is all crinkly. What is
hey guys,
this?
What was that episode where the blackened cabbage attacked? That could be any number of Doctor Who monsters. Yep.
But there's actually a lot to talk about in Keeper of Trakan.
It's a really good episode.
Yes. I'm going to straight up agree with Tony right now. because I'm going to bulwark this against Josh's terrible looks that he's giving me right now.
I like Keeper of Trakan.
I like Keeper of Trakan a great deal.
Are we all agreeing here off the bat?
I think we are. I mean, I think there's some little niggles about Keeper of Trakan, but that's all of 50-plus years of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
It's a niggle fest.
So this is the second to last Tom Baker episode. He's very kind of weary. He's not the super exuberant running around.
He doesn't seem like a Marx brother.
No.
But I think that's part of why it's so good, because you have this balance. He's still charming, but he's not manic.
Yes.
Or as manic. And Adric is written well, which is rare. I, there's one thing I saw in the extras was Johnny Byrne talking about how he really had an affection for Adric's character and how he was really just treated so badly after this once they started getting to be so many characters and the writers clearly didn't like him very much. But it's really fun to see Adric and the Doctor playing against each other. And for most of the episode, Adric is just running around doing stuff on his own and being reasonably competent.
Yeah,
not at all dumb.
He's kind of the Doctor to Nyssa's companion.
Yeah,
Nyssa's his companion.
He reminded me a lot in this episode because he's written very proactively and he's smart. He's not whiny. He reminded me of like genderless Zoe.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he reminded me a lot. Yeah. And so then I started imagining him in a futuristic, sparkly cat suit. Well, things got really bad after that.
But yeah, it really seemed like Adric and Nyssa were partners, and there wasn't any kind of weird teenage romance layered onto it whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're totally right, Tony. When we talked about this last week, which is before I had rewatched Keeper of Trakan, and you're like, I thought Adric was great, or what? I was like, what is this guy talking about? I don't. But no, it's absolutely right. Okay, Matthew Waterhouse has never been a great actor or whatever, but he's completely competent here.
Yeah.
Until he has to act against the wind.
No one survives that. No, everyone is terrible there. So you got to give the guy a pass.
He's the only guy who ends up with the unfortunate full shot of the wind trying to blow him away.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh man, you flunked out of mime school early, buddy.
But yeah, this is one of the comparatively few Doctor stories where his companion's a guy.
Yep.
Yeah.
And a competent person. He doesn't have to denigrate him the way he does Harry Sullivan several years earlier.
Yeah, I mean,
he actually gives him credit. When he's talking to Tremos, he says, blah, 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 to defeat the Melker. This is just an idea that Adric and I had.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so strange.
The Doctor never really says things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if some of the performance is just Matthew Waterhouse being really intimidated by Tom Baker and keeping it under control. Right?
I imagine Tom Baker would intimidate a lot of people.
So what about the rest of the story? Nyssa is kind of a non-entity here. She's
really stronger than she is later in the series when she becomes a companion. She takes
Tegan
a lot
really
of,
overwhelmed. The,
yeah. Oh yeah, I mean, she shoots yeah. people in this one. Yeah.
She does.
She yes. bribes and then shoots. Mm-hmm. When the bribe doesn't work, she escalates to shooting.
I do find her very charming, very relaxed mm-hmm. here. It's too bad that the inherent tragedy of the master stealing her father's body and then walking around in it like a corpse suit
yes.
is never really developed in the later season.
Yeah, they yeah. really...
Well, I can understand.
And when, you know, when Trocken gets wiped out in the whole... in the second... in Logopolis.
Oh, yeah.
It's like you know... And I my best retcon for this is just Trocken is such a empathetic, understanding society that they're like, oh, my world's gone. Hmm. You know, like that would be just kind of the reaction you would have.
They had a, I'd they like had to react, run. But that would require acting.
Yeah, that's a good emotional backfilling there, Calvin.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, everything in Keeper of Trakken is a complete and utter failure from that perspective, because Trakken is destroyed in the very next episode. It's like Alien 3, right? Like everything yeah. you fought for in mm-hmm. Aliens.
There is,
everybody's dead now.
There is an audio adventure, or I can't remember if it's an audio adventure or a novel or a short story.
It's
or
probably
something,
all of those.
where they find some little outpost of Trocken that didn't get wiped out.
Oh. Well, that's a later audio adapted from yeah. a proposal by Johnny Byrne from the 80s, and Big Finish turned it into a full audio with the Sixth Doctor and Perry.
Oh,
they
okay.
find one last outpost, and it goes into the origins of the Melker. What the original Melkers were and why Trocken calls all evil things Melker.
Okay.
Because of this thing, this old story. There is also another Big Finish audio that is a prequel to Keeper of Trocken by Lance Parkin about the origins of the Source and the Keeper.
Wow, you guys.
We just had a little nerd moment.
Yeah. Whoa. Ooh, my Back pants. To... My pants are so hot right now.
I've got... Why didn't I wear the looser fitting pants?
Wow. Okay.
But yeah, no, I... speaking of Trocken... Trocken pants.
This is the way Kelvin picks up ladies. Speaking of Trocken.
Well, for one thing, I really love the design in this movie. I love yeah. the sets and the costumes. It's like this
really cool,
really yeah. cool mixture of like Renaissance and Art Nouveau.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On one of the extras, the director was talking about how he was dating an art designer at the time, and I think she was part of the BBC shop, and they decided that they would do Art Nouveau because art designers all love Art Nouveau, and they just really ran with it. And there was a set designer who I think was new that they brought in, and they described it to him. And he was the one who came up with all the great designs for the gates and the structures. And I think he said he took Art Nouveau and went with sort of a Gaudi architectural combination,
yeah.
and that's why everything is just so, so interesting in the background.
Yeah, Antonio. Mm-hmm. Or Gaudi, not...
Yes.
Not Gaudi.
Gaudi, not Gaudi.
Yes, yeah. okay.
Yeah.
But Trocken is supposed to be sort of this ultimate utopian kind of society, you know, an empire formed by people just being extremely nice to each other.
We're all proud of our liberal tradition, but...
yeah, for like such a utopian society, they seem pretty eager to apply the death penalty.
Yeah. Yes.
It's like, well, I will take responsibility for them. Well, okay, Trimas, but you realize that if they do anything wrong, we have to
yeah.
kill you.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And it's they quickly arm everybody. Yeah. They yeah. bribe people.
It's a super fragile gerontocracy.
Yes.
Like the late Soviet Union. You know, it just takes the slightest worrying development to get everybody plotting against
well, yeah,
one
I mean,
another.
I mean, isn't like basically the Source just kind of forces everyone to be peaceful?
Yeah.
It's, like,
yeah,
what is the Source?
What that
exactly.
tranquility, the power he has
yeah.
over everyone.
And
he's creepy as hell, isn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. And I always think, you know, a utopian society would have, like, theoretically, lots of representation in government. The entire government seems to be five people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. Old people.
Five yeah. old people. Well, the
one guy.
The woman who the Melker influences.
Cassia
seems pretty young.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's clearly repressed because she quickly falls in love with an evil statue.
Oh, so. Poor Cassia. You know, I mean, she seems like such a sweet person in the flashback, mm-hmm. but the Master's clearly been working on her for years because by the time the Doctor gets there, she's totally crazy pants.
Yeah.
And another thing that's interesting about this episode is the opening sequence, which has this exposition told in a sort of narrated fashion when the Keeper arrives in the TARDIS and he gives us this backstory. It has this really fairy tale quality, this world that is so good that it captures evil in a garden and turns it into a statue, and it doesn't match this sort of, well, we're scientists and we don't want superstition to take hold in our garden of goodness and evil.
Yeah. It just seems like the population just readily accepts some kind of weird supernatural thing, like instantly, despite being like supposedly some multi-planet society. Well,
it's also supposed to be sort of a millennialism analogy. That was another thing that I heard Johnny Byrne talking about, where so this society has been going on for 1,000 years, but we're catching it at the tail end where things are starting to fray apart because the Keeper's about to pass and the Master has been in the garden plotting for decades and all.
Yeah, the Keeper's been the Keeper for 1,000 years.
We get all
the
fairy tale from the Keeper, but now we're seeing after the fairy tale, or as the fairy tale is about to normally gets reborn, but it's just going to get destroyed.
If anything, it reminds me less of fairy tales, although Cassia being the evil stepmother kind of inclines in that direction, and more towards some of these old-fashioned Christian allegory novels like Everyman or the Pilgrim's
Progress. Paralandra.
That's a 20th century version of things like Pilgrim's Progress or whatever. So things like they say the air was so full of goodness that evil just shriveled up and died, and Cassia being in love with a physical statued embodiment of evil. These things are strange and theological in a way that Doctor Who doesn't do very much. Evil is somehow a detectable concept that's recognized by the trachenic atmosphere and is trapped.
Yeah, it's true.
It becomes fertilizer there. Yes. That is something out of John Bunyan. Right?
And of course the Melker isn't really all that trapped. It's the Master and his TARDIS, which he made statue-shaped and just gonna sit here for a couple years plotting while my body rots away.
A few words about Anthony Ainley. I think he's terrific here. He totally goes over the top in the as the Master later on, but I think he's very likable here.
Oh, as Tramos?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to kind of forget that this is before he's become the Master, because it's weird to see him, because he wears disguises later on as the Master.
He's like, when's he going to pull off the beard?
There's that part of me that goes, it's the Master!
he does an amazing job just being like a kindly old guy.
You really have to imagine seeing this for the first time.
Yeah, I remember
recognizing him as Anthony Ainley and as the Master and going, oh, wow, the Master just totally stole this awesome, smart old guy's body by kind of mounting him from behind. But we will talk about that.
This has got to be like Anthony Ainley's last real acting job, right?
Yeah.
Because he didn't do much of anything after this. He was just the Master. And then he kind of retired from acting and then died about 10 years ago. So, yeah, this is kind of his last actually doing an acting job role.
I love Jeffrey Beavers, though, if we're talking Master. He has this melodic, evil voice that sounds almost like Boris Karloff to me. It is so good. And I love when he gets extra crazy, that sort of weird demonic screech at the end that he does when he realizes everything's going wrong. And in that makeup, it's really... It distressed me watching it as a grown adult. I was like, this is a little,
It's also interesting that the Master is only revealed toward the end of episode 3, and then he just turns toward the camera, and we see his ravaged body. This has to be an indication that the producers expect the audience to understand who that is, or at least some percentage of the audience to understand who it is, because there's enough publicity and there's enough fan material out there.
I think the Deadly Assassin was I could be wrong about this, but I think it was like a popular, well-received enough story that the decrepit, cadaverous Master was like a thing in the public conscience.
Yeah, so people would recognize it.
Yeah.
Even a few years before, that wouldn't necessarily have been the case, that this kind of continuity would be recognizable to the public.
Yeah. The other interesting thing to me is right now while we're recording this, we are right in the middle of Series 9, and we have talked a lot about the Missy Master as a friend of the Doctor's and sort of this throwback to the Legato era. And here we see where there is no friendship. There is utter animosity.
It's vampiric.
Yeah, they hate each other. The Fourth Doctor has a great line where he says, I used to know an ancient remedy for mad dogs. I must look it up sometime. I mean, there is he has no, softness for this master.
That's about as close as you see any of the original series doctors basically just saying you should die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Final thoughts on Keeper of Draken, you guys?
This is kind of dumb, but I always really liked that very late Tom Baker costume with like the burgundy coat and the
Ewan Carey, she loves that, and the
sort of reddish scarf and the maybe not the question marks so much, but the lapels on the shirt.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but I just really always like that kind of.
Well, it fits in with his character too. It's much more subdued.
Yeah.
I mean, like a lot of Doctor Who, you scratch at the surface, and we raise some of the questions here. There are a lot of odd things about the Trakan Union, and you think too hard about it. It doesn't totally play, but it looks so nice, and I think overall the performances are really nice, and the word that keeps popping to mind is pleasant. It's a surprisingly quiet, pleasant, underrated Doctor Who story.
Yeah. How does it fit in, Tony, now that you've looked at it years later?
I'm really happy that this turned out to be the one that I had to watch for the episode. The art design is great. Anthony Ainley as Trimess is holding his own with the Doctor for the most part. Mm-hmm. And it's a really well-balanced episode.
Yeah, it's not the sort of thing that you would want to introduce a new fan to, because it's too sedate, probably, but I was happily surprised to see Matthew Waterhouse do such a good job.
It might be the best, like, penultimate Doctor story. No, wait, Day of the Doctor is a penultimate Doctor story.
We'll do a Death Zone on this. So, for round four, I've got something new, you guys. I call it The Game of Rassilon.
Oh, geez.
Or Trivia of the Exelons. Whichever you prefer.
Okay. Are we going to be turned into little bas reliefs around a crypt at the end of
I hope so. But in the meantime, I'm going to ask you all a couple of questions. So I've got three questions for each of you fellows, and I have a tiebreaker question if it's needed. And I have a Doctor Who-related prize for whichever one of you gets the most answers right. Listeners, feel free to play along at home, although I have nothing to give you. Question one, Kelvin.
Is this like just me?
It's multiple choice. It's for you.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a question and give you four potential answers.
All right.
A, B, C, or D. You can tell me which one is correct.
Okay.
Kelvin, which of these classic series actresses appeared in the 1970 Tygon Productions film The Blood on Satan's Claw? Is it A? Shut up, Josh. You'll have your turn, Josh. Is it A, Wendy Padbury, B, Annika Wills, C, Deborah Watling, or D, Caroline John?
Boy, they're all very plausible.
I know. I wrote these questions so that they would be plausible.
Plausible bastard.
Deborah Watling.
C, Deborah Watling. Is that your final answer?
Yes.
It's incorrect. I'm sorry. Josh knew it. Who was it, Josh?
Wendy Padbury.
You're right.
Oh, yes. I was going to say Wendy Padbury.
0 points.
I steal. I don't know if that's a structure in this game, but I stole it.
No stealing. Question two for Josh. Which of these classic series actresses appeared in the 1979 ITV television series Danger UXB? Is it A, Wendy Padbury, B, Annika Wills, C, Deborah Watling, or D, Caroline John?
I knew the first one. Caroline John.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
It's incorrect.
No!
I'm sorry, it was Deborah Watling.
No!
Kelvin's answer to question one. So we got zero and zero so far. Tony?
There's a wonderful symmetry to this
there
so far.
Is.
Tony?
Always vote C. No. Wait, what do we got?
Which of these Doctor Who actors appeared in the 1973 Amicus film The Vault of Horror? Was it A, Patrick Troughton, B, John Pertwee, C, Tom Baker, or D, Peter Cushing?
Oh, Peter Cushing.
D your final answer?
Yes.
No, always guess C. It's Tom Baker.
I knew that one.
We are going to need a tiebreaker for this.
After round one, it's 0-0-0. All right, going into round two. No
steals.
No steals. We'll work that into a revised structure for a later podcast.
All right.
All right, Kelvin, I've got a question for you here.
Yes.
Which of the following science fiction writers wrote the Doctor Who novel The Coming of the Terrifiles?
Okay.
Is it A, Douglas Adams, B, Michael Moorcock, C, Brian Aldiss, or D, Russell T. Davies?
I'm really amused by the idea of Brian Aldiss writing a Doctor Who novel. But it's B, Michael Moorcock.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Yeah, and you're correct.
Yes.
You looked to the right, you would have seen a copy of that book over there.
You were pointing to an entire wall full of books, so it wasn't like the single book sitting on your coffee table that Kelvin should have noticed.
Completely empty shelf, except for Mike Moorcock's The Coming of the Terrifiles. Yeah,
with the other 3,000 books that you just gestured towards.
Oh, Jonathan Franzen wrote a Doctor Who novel.
I should have put him as a possibility. All right, Josh, let's see if you can get up to Kelvin's level here. Which of these famous comic book writers has not written a story set in the Doctor Who universe? A, Alan Moore, B, Neil Gaiman, C, Grant Morrison, or D, Brian Michael Bendis?
I'm going to say D.
D, Brian Michael Bendis, is that your final answer?
Yes, it is.
And it's correct.
Yes!
Oh, very good.
What did Alan Moore write?
Alan Moore wrote some kind of timey-wimey war stuff, backup features about Gallifrey for Doctor Who magazine way back in the day. It's never been reprinted. It's very hard to come by, but he did write it.
I hate myself for not knowing that. I should know that.
I hate you for not knowing that.
I will send you copies of it. Very hard to find.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Tony, if you can tie these sons of bitches.
I don't know.
Which of these classic Doctor Who stories is very similar in plot to the 1966 Avengers episode Man-Eater of Surrey Green? Is it A, the Time Monster, B, the Time Warrior, C, the Seeds of Death, or D, the Seeds of Doom?
I think it's the Seeds of Death.
C, the Seeds of Death. Is that your final answer?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's incorrect. It's D, the Seeds of Doom.
The other one.
The crinoid.
Crinoid.
I love the crinoid.
Yes. All right, so you're falling behind here, Tony.
What's the Seeds of Death?
Seeds of Death is the second Ice Warriors episode. It's a Patrick Troughton one. Yeah. It's got foam.
Where he's attacked by foam.
It's attacked by foam a lot.
Yep.
All right, so there's still time to come back, Tony. Assuming Kelvin and Josh flub these next questions, which I'm sure they will. So,
gee whiz. Thank you, Alex Trebek.
Kelvin, this 1999 Virgin Bernice Summerfield novel by Mark Clapham and John DeBerg Miller shares its name with a Richard Wagner opera. Is it A, The Flying Dutchman, B, Lohengrin, C, Twilight of the Gods, or D, The Fairies? Put your hand down, Josh.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Mark Clapham and John DeBerg Miller.
That doesn't help.
Twilight of the Gods, just because it's the most Doctor Who-y sounding title.
C, Twilight of the Gods?
Yes.
Your final answer?
Yes.
You're correct.
Yes!
Twilight of the Gods it is. So we got 2-1-0 here, but there's still time.
I want all of Kelvin's questions from now on.
Josh?
I've known them across the board.
This 1998 Virgin Doctor Who novel by Paul Mars shares its name with a Marlena Dietrich film. Is it A, Golden Earrings, B, Shanghai Express, C, The Scarlet Empress, or D, Knight Without Armor?
C, The Scarlet Empress.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Yeah, it is correct.
Yes!
Tony, you can't get up with them, but let's see if you can if you have a moral victory here.
Yeah.
All right. This 1999 Virgin Doctor Who novel by Paul Mars shares its name with a Marlena Dietrich film. Is it A, The Blue Angel, B, A Foreign Affair, C, Touch of Evil, or D, Stage Fright? 1999 Virgin.
No. All right, Josh, what is it?
Josh and his compulsive consumption of alternative media.
Stick with C, whatever C is.
Touch of Evil?
Sure.
Final answer?
Sure.
Incorrect.
Of course.
Josh, what is it? Of course it is. All right, so you and Calvin are tied. That means the tiebreaker question.
Oh, dear.
So this is not multiple choice. It's just whichever one of you gets closest to the right answer will win the prize.
First, by just yelling out or punching someone first.
That's a good question. Maybe I will point to you while the other one holds their ears.
This is the worst idea ever.
Exactly.
There's a reason you've never run a game show. I'd love it if there were actual rules in a game show.
Josh, hold Kelvin's ears.
That's the best, worst idea ever.
So write it down.
Write it down, yes. Okay. Reach behind you, please, Josh. Grab one of the many pens and pencils there. Also,
the only one that isn't sharpened.
Give one to Calvin too while you're at it. Grab some post-it notes. Are you guys ready?
Yep.
Sure.
For the tiebreaker question, not counting Shada, but counting Mission to the Unknown, and counting the Trial of a Time Lord as a single story, how many individual stories are there in the classic series? I can't do that.
We're gonna get sued.
Do the match game one.
I'm just gonna take a wild guess.
You're gonna take a wild guess? Write it down, son.
I did.
All right, have you both written down your answers?
Yes.
All right, reveal them, please. Kelvin? 247. Josh?
Wow. 129.
Well, there are 155 stories. Oh. So
that's closest to Josh.
That is closest to Josh. Josh wins this round of Trivia of the Exelons.
Wow.
Josh, I'm going to give you here as your prize this copy of the Doctor Who role-playing game module, The ITN Menace.
I'm going to play this.
You can play with your children if you ever get a copy of the actual role-playing game. And
I just beat Kelvin. That's enough of a win.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, everyone, and tune in next time whenever we decide to do this for the next round of the Game of Rassilon or Trivia of the Douchebags. All right. Our fifth and final round, the Death Zone.
Ba-bum.
This is where we pair two Doctor Who texts, actors, companions, whatever we feel like, and we make them fight in the Death Zone, and we decide which one is better, which one comes out on top. In this case, we're going to talk about the 2003 Big Finish audio story, Deadline, by Rob Shearman, and the 2013 television movie, An Adventure in Space and Time, by Mark Gatiss. The reason we're pairing these up is because they're both reflections on the earliest years of Doctor Who. They're very different in approach and tone, but on this, our anniversary episode, we thought it was a good time to address these anniversary Doctor Who stories. So, who wants to start? Tony, as our guest, do you want to talk about Deadline?
Sure. In that it was terrible. It's a Doctor Who story that has nothing to do with Doctor Who, except it's about an alternate version of the writer who never actually did Doctor Who, and he's just a bitter old man in an elderly home and dies in a closet.
You know what? I'm with you. I thought it was depressing.
Yes.
I thought the character was not sympathetic on any level. even though he's played by Derek Jacobi, he's like one of the greatest actors in the world. But yeah, I'm just like, I couldn't figure out why I was listening to this. I couldn't figure out what the point was.
Exactly.
Okay, three words. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
I know.
Bring it.
One of the interesting things about this is part of the Doctor Who Unbound series that Big Finish did. This is an audio story, and it is part of Big Finish's 40th anniversary celebration. And this is before the new series has aired, because part of what I love about this is that today, in the post-new series world, you would never have an anniversary story of any kind that is this cynical.
Yeah.
We are so used to now that the new series is on the air, all the old references to Doctor Who, all the nerdy little fan service is all spoon-fed to us. And here it is also spoon-fed, but every spoonful is also poison. It is at the same time a celebration of Doctor Who, but it's also an indictment. And everything that you're laughing at or enjoying also has this sharp stab to it. It's like a bizarro anniversary story, and I laughed a lot.
So you're
possibly too much, but this is a funny, dark story.
I didn't get one laugh out of this.
Really?
I don't understand what.
Not even Doctor Who, you utter bastard. That is a line in this story.
Not really.
Let me say it again, Calvin. Doctor Who, you utter bastard.
There's a lot to be said for context.
Okay. And that's the thing, is all of the points you're talking about are not about the piece. They're about, other than you love the dark tone of it all, it's all about the context of the piece. And I understood that, but as a piece unto itself, I just found it to be so unpleasant that I willfully did not go in to find out what the context of
it was. It was like watching someone die of Alzheimer's.
Yes,
which would be hilarious.
But in a certain context, maybe, but yes. I don't know.
Robert Shearman has a dark sense of humor. Okay, and this is a very comedic piece. For any audience out there who have not heard it and are choosing to listen to this podcast without hearing it, it is this idea that a sort of hack writer who was once a promising theatrical playwright decides to denigrate himself by writing for television, and he is working on the pilot for this show called Doctor Who that never gets off the ground. It's never even filmed.
It has a lot of information developed out of fan understanding of the early years of Doctor Who. It talks about Sidney Newman, and there's kind of a belabored joke about whether he's from Australia or from Canada. But it relies for a lot of its effectiveness on the idea that you are not only affectionate toward Doctor Who, but are well-versed in the early years of it, which is why I found it so remarkable that this is really just Rob Sherman just all over the early years of Doctor Who. I loved it for exactly that reason. I found it more unpleasant than hilarious, but I mean, I look at it from a literary or generic point of view, meaning genre point of view, so it fits in well with a tradition of British misery guts storytelling, unhappy people.
And that's exactly a genre that I really don't enjoy. Yeah. So that's part of the reason why I didn't like this, because it hits right in one of the types of literature or performance that I just don't enjoy to begin with.
Fair enough.
So that's why we're all getting such individual reactions to it, because I think it is hitting all of us very, very personally, depending on where we're coming from. It's not so much of a general Doctor Who story.
It's always sort of bugged me when writers have their main character be a writer.
You think it's narcissistic?
I find it inherently narcissistic, and
even a story like this that is about narcissism, that is one of the themes of the story.
I don't know. I mean, the only other people who might be more narcissistic than a writer might be an actor, and I'm technically both.
Disqualified.
But
extremely qualified.
You know, even when I see, you know, stories that are about writers and I really enjoy them, I still feel kind of vaguely manipulated by it in a way that I don't normally
feel if they were had some other kind of profession.
You know, I think that's fair.
That's fair. Or like Fahrenheit 451, which is like a writer writing about how important writers are as the end conclusion. And there's a there is something a little narcissistic.
I like I like Fahrenheit 451 a lot more than I like this story, but
I like this better.
Well, there is there is kind of a break in terms of what you expect from writers, right? Do you want them to be expressive about psychology and individual feeling, or do you want them to be social novelists like Dickens or Trollope or somebody who's writing about conditions in the world? There's not obviously a clear line between those two things, but here I think Rob Sherman is digging deep. He's clearly in a unhappy mood when he's writing this story, and he's digging to the bottom of some of the unhappier elements of what the idea of Doctor Who is, you know, failed writers and hack storylines. And one of the things I admire about Deadline so much is how it seems to imply that even the idea of Doctor Who itself is so completely arbitrary, right? There's still going to be a need out there for fandom to express itself, and if it's not going to be Doctor Who, which we all like, it's going to be Juliet Bravo, which as Americans, I don't quite get it, but it's like the Cagney and Lacey or Heart to Heart of...
It's that era,
Yeah, so essentially primetime garbage.
Yeah.
Right, so that's where fandom goes in the fictional world of Deadline. It goes to Julia Bravo and not Dr.
science fiction, so...
And the interviewer is clearly Terrence Dix, right?
Yeah.
He's got his speech impediment, which I thought was kind of cruel, but...
I didn't get that until just now, but it's Terrence Dix. Oh, God.
Part of what I love about it is it says, come close, fans.
Yes.
Let me take out your jugular.
That thing you like could have easily been this garbage thing.
Well, and you're pointing out that this is before the new series even starts, really. Yeah. It explains so much more about the tone.
Yep.
But you guys, this is the Death Zone.
Yep.
Yeah.
We can't just have Deadline fight itself. We have to talk about...
They kind of did, though, I think. But anyway.
Yes. We have to talk about an adventure in space and time.
Yeah,
this is 2013.
Yep.
This is the 50th anniversary. So 10 years after Deadline, it's got, what's his name, Walder Frey, and the guy from Harry Potter as William Hartnell, David Bradley. What do we think about this?
It looks beautiful. There are great performances, but I'm going to probably be in the minority here to say this is a story that thinks it's being sentimental and hopeful, but I think it's actually far, far more depressing than Deadline,
well,
in my opinion.
And that it's real, and that all this happened.
But then it tries to give this hopeful moment at the finish that
is
utterly imagined. Yeah. And, you know, I might be hung up on, and we're cutting right to the chase, and I apologize, we should probably back up, but I'm going to just go there, is this... that Matt Smith cameo that is purely for the viewers in my mind, that says this is a depressing, dreary story, but we're going to imagine that Matt Smith appeared to William Hartnell at the end before he went, you know, bat poop crazy and had a miserable life until he died and gave this heartening smile to him that made everything worthwhile. Yeah. It's a way to give the viewers an out for what is... the way it's presented is a really depressing story, the downward spiral of not only an actor, but of a man.
I don't want to go. I don't want to go.
Yeah.
I mean, that bit is obviously tacked on manipulation, but the rest of it is pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. So you can just ignore that little 5-second bit of Matt
Smith.
Fair
enough.
It's a very sentimentalized depiction. I don't think anyone would be able to watch like a really honest portrayal of what William Hartnell was like. He sounds like an incredibly difficult man to get along with, racist, and all that.
They did ignore the racism for the most part.
Well, I mean, if anything, they play against it because they have Waris Hussein being such a strong character, and really the only one who says anything against him is that one piddly little cameraman who mentions something about, oh, he should be used to being hot, and the floor manager kind of looks at him askance, like, you shouldn't be talking like
that. They nod toward the things we know about Bill Hartnell without making it a big deal.
Yeah.
Before we leave An Adventure in Space and Time, I do want to mention, and we're going to link to this in the show notes, an epic takedown of An Adventure in Space and Time by none other than Lawrence Miles, the biggest contrarian in Doctor Who. I usually find myself agreeing with more often than not. Mm-hmm. So he of course, worked himself into a frenzy about An Adventure in Space and Time. He absolutely hated it for many reasons, but in particular for the characterizations of Verity Lambert and Sidney Newman. Oh. And he knows more about this history than I do. I'll just read a few sentences. Verity Lambert, the greatest left-wing feminist firebrand in the history of British television, reduced by this script to a simpering girl who learns self-confidence, aged 28, and only becomes a proper character when she shouts down Sidney Newman in his office after he pushes her that one step too far. Sidney Newman, the most inventive producer of his era. Among the people he promoted in their TV careers were Harold Pinter, Dennis Potter, and Ken Loach. Again, he apparently did this despite being a mogul from 3 decades previously who just couldn't resist sticking that cheroot in his mouth while going, "Walk, walk, walk," like the Penguin. In short, the person who first thought of Doctor Who, then summoned up the best people to make it happen, is a corporate monster who lurks behind a desk and dwells on the ratings despite having no real reason to do so, etc., etc., etc. So, from Lawrence Miles' point of view, this is character assassination at the highest level. It, in the interest of fitting it into a pre-existing type of script storyline.
Biopics can't be documentaries. Yeah. I mean, they just can't be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's extremely formulaic. There's no question there. I mean, it's good to see that contrary opinion.
What do we owe to the dead when you do something like this, right? Yeah. Do we just make up whatever about them that we like?
I totally agree on one hand. On the other hand, this is so flagrantly stylized. Mm. I have a hard time thinking anyone in the audience would sit and watch that whole sequence where they're flashing between the script of the Daleks and the Kennedy assassination, that this is anything other than a comic book version of the origins of Doctor Who.
Isn't that how we learn history these days? Because of what people show us, right?
You can't make a story, a film about a historical event, a documentary, unless it's a documentary.
Yeah.
You know, that's a thing I always have a big problem with, is like these people who
criticize. But isn't there some obligation to be true?
That they have to be documentaries. Like, that's the only thing they could ever possibly accept. Hard documentary.
But isn't Lawrence Miles just saying that these things are completely flagrantly wrong about the characters of Verity Lambert and Sidney Newman, that it's character assassination? It's not just slightly fictionalized.
Well, that's why they say it's based on a true story and not is a true story.
No,
there's no way you can do blow-by-blow depictions that are absolutely accurate to what someone is without it being dramatically, totally unengaging, I think. I just don't think it's possible.
It wouldn't have been hard to be more accurate with as inaccurate as it was. But the formula of the movie they decided to make, there's no way Verity Lambert could have been a left-wing firebrand progressive producer because of the relationship they set up with her and William Hartnell. She couldn't have been a strong character because then she could have done something about
if
him being
did,
let
if
go.
If they did, it would
so
be a six-hour movie.
Yeah, but that way it was all back on Sydney in the front office about William leaving, and then that you could get that little moment at the end with her and Hartnell saying, "Oh, you were so good, and you were so good to me." And you know, but if she was a stronger character, you wouldn't be able to have that grandfather-granddaughter dynamic in the formulaic movie that they decided to make.
Yeah. I just want a whole story that's about William Russell as the parking lot attendant. Like a 6-part series.
What is he like?
I would watch
William
that.
Russell's like, what, 95 now?
Yeah, I'd totally tune in. I would pirate that.
So you guys, I mean, yes, he's 90, by the way.
90.
I just looked that up. Having said all this, I think it is terrible for all those reasons. I did get a little verklempt in it. You know, it's shamelessly manipulative.
It works on an emotional level more than an intellectual level.
It's what we want to think about Doctor Who.
This is the second time I watched it, and the first time I watched it, I hated it beyond words.
Yeah. Well, it's Mark Gatiss, and he should die.
I give it a second chance, and I liked it a little better because I accepted that it is just this, again, comic book version of reality. I still absolutely despise the Matt Smith cameo. It goes beyond sentimental to just be an absolute deranged lie. I mean, I can't describe it any other way. And so I think we might know how the panelists are going to vote here.
Yeah.
But I think we should still go to the final round here. It's the death zone, people.
Well, Tony, as our guest, Deadline versus An Adventure in Space and Time.
Well, that's definitely a hard pair of choices.
I know, that's why it's the death zone. Well, it's not the puppy zone.
The main choice that I make is that I dislike Adventure in Space and Time less than I dislike Deadline. I'm voting for
that's fair. For
that's often where a position I'm in.
Yeah. Kelvin?
Yeah, I got to go with An Adventure in Space and Time. I guess I just prefer Mush over Venom.
I prefer Venom over Mush.
Yeah.
I go with Deadline because I think Deadline has a lot of truth in it, whether it be about Doctor Who or not. And I think Adventure in Space and Time is much uglier, ironically, than Deadline, which is an ugly, ugly story.
Wow, okay.
But it doesn't have a veneer of sentimentality on top of it. It takes the veneer off and just says, yep, here's an ugly story, whereas An Adventure in Space and Time tries to present an ugly story as something sweet and sentimental and romantic.
Yeah, everything Josh said. So I'm there too. Right. I mean, I could have said it simpler by just saying Rob Shearman versus Mark Gatiss, but there we are.
Even great writers can write terrible things, and even bad writers can write something good once in a while.
So Kelvin, when you die, I'm going to write the story of your life where you're the fascist dictator of South Minneapolis.
Someone probably will. He's dead. He can't complain.
Well, you guys, I think that's it this episode of Get Off My World. Mm-hmm. It's been epic.
Yeah.
It's been contentious.
Yeah. It's been a while since we had this sharp of a split on something. I just,
We edited out the fist fight that happened.
So until next time, whenever that time will be, I'm Pat.
I'm Tony.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Kelvin.
And we're saying...
Get off my world!
I'm...
Do you need to hear them again?
Yeah, what was C again?
C was Deborah Watling.
Deborah Watling, okay.
Victoria.
Yeah.
But you knew that.
Yes. Boy, oh boy, oh boy.
I'm going to edit all this thinking out. Just so you know.
You're not going to do the Jeopardy. Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. We don't have the rights to do that.
Nuts. I'm going to go with...